Okay, I'm going to give this name a sort of intro that Ted gave. This is not a talk for experts. This is an expository lecture. Basically, I'm going to tell you about a few examples of the use of ordinal indices in Banach space theory, how they're used to get some structural information. And so I'm going to start with one of the ones that made an early appearance, and that's something called the Schlenk index. And here's its definition. Take a subset of the space and a subset of the dual, and you are going to extract subsets of that set B in the dual here. I can do this. And then, now, so notice you're taking a sequence out of the set you've constructed in the dual to make the alpha plus first one. So you're going to do this for every alpha less than omega 1. And you also extract a sequence out of the set in the space. And the sequence in the space is going to 0 weakly. The sequence in the dual is going weak star to some point. And the point is what you're trying to place in the next set. And the condition is that as this you move along the two sequences, they see each other. But of course, if you were to fix one and let the other one go, you would get 0. So you're picking up some sort of actually non-uniform convergence is the way I tend to think of it. Then you do the usual thing at limit ordinals. You take an intersection. Now, typically, the sets A and B are just the unit ball. And this gives you something that's considered the Schlenk index of the space itself. But you can apply it to other things. So this is the typical situation as the unit ball here. And if you want the thing to come out to be an accountable ordinal for sure, then you should assume that X star is separable. Then you can guarantee that. And you just go along until you hit the empty set. You're getting weak star closed sets every time, so it's got to stop. You're inside a metric space. It's actually separable, so you get this stopping point. And then if you let epsilon go, you get this isomorphic invariant here. And then just as a convention, if it doesn't work, you call the index omega 1. Okay, now how do these things come out? Well, one little general note is this here at the bottom, that if you cut epsilon by a factor of k, that increases how far you can go in the set. So that means that you're always going to get these limit ordinals of a particular form here for the index. Okay. Now, Schlenk introduced this to solve a particular universal space problem. And so one of the things he observed was that this index pays attention to both its subspaces. And well, he did this for quotient spaces. He later noticed that it also works for subspaces, that the index pays attention to both of them. So if you want to prove that you don't have a universal space and you have this ordinal isomorphic invariant, what you need to do is simply show that you can get spaces with arbitrarily large index, and then there must not be any universal space. And that's, in fact, what he did. So Schlenk wanted to know whether there was a universal separable reflexive space. So in other words, this would contain all separable reflexive spaces. And he proved that there is no such thing. And actually, the spaces that he uses here are very simple, in fact. So you start out with L2, and then if you, let's call that X1, and then to build the alpha plus 1 space, you just add on each time a copy of L2. But for computational reasons, it's better to add that in an L1 sense here as you do it. And then if you want, if you're in this, and you only do this finitely many times, when you come to a limit ordinal, say beta, right, then what you do is you do look at everything you've done up to that point, but now you take a little L2 sum to keep the thing reflexive. And so these are the spaces he uses, and he computes the index, which isn't too difficult in this case. And so you get these, this first usage. Okay, so there's an example. Now, let me see here. What I'm going to do is I'm going to leave this definition up there for the people who are not so familiar with this. And let me look at a couple of things that have shown up in the literature. The Schlenk index, that definition with the weakly null sequences, it may seem a little peculiar and hard to understand. So if you exclude little L1 from your space, then you can get an equivalent index by simply looking at separated sequences in the dual, right? So you take xn star converges x star, and xn star is away from x star, a distance epsilon, and use that. And then what you get is something that's essentially equivalent. The sets aren't exactly the same, but the behavior is the same. And so you can use this thing instead. And people have varied the Schlenk definition for various purposes. Here's one example from a paper a few years ago of Godefroy, Kaltman, and Lansian. Here they wanted to ensure that they had convex things at every stage, so they throw in the convex hull as they work along. And they were mostly interested, in fact, in small ordinals, finite, in fact, in the application here. And I recommend Gilles wrote an expository paper, which I've forgotten, topology in Banach spaces or something. Right. So you can look there if you're interested. And there's also some things that are more in a set theory vein in that article. Okay, now let's look at the question. The what?
The A doesn't
play in the dual. Right, this is a definition for the special case where you take the unit balls. Okay, that was for the case where you take A as the unit ball. Okay, but it's easier to compute, right, because you're, and it turns out to give the same information in the case of the balls. So if you're interested in computing it just for the ball, for A being the unit ball of the space, then this definition works in the same way. Okay. All right. Now, another way of getting a little feeling is to go to sort of a classical situation where the sort of ordinal index thing showed up topologically, and that's to recall the basic result of Mazurkiewicz and Sierpinski was the topological classification of the countable compact metric spaces, right? So if you remember, right, all you do is define the derived sets by taking non-trivial limits, and you know it's sort of the same thing as in the Schlenk definition then, okay? And of course, the way it comes out is that this comes to be homeomorphic to an ordinal interval, right, and the determining factor, and it's omega to the gamma, where the gamma is the number of derived sets, and the little n here is the cardinality of what's in the last non-empty set. Okay, now suppose you take the continuous functions on this thing, and you want to compute the Schlenk index of that space. Okay, so here you are using the balls for the two sets. Well, one thing that's easy to see just by straightforward computation is that if you take the Dirac measure that's sitting at one of these last points, like omega to the gamma, it's going to set in the gamma times the greatest integer in 1 over epsilon set. Okay, that's easy to see because you simply move along the derived sets of the underlying topological space, and you move an epsilon bit each time. So that's the way it comes out. And now, to see that this is really what's going on. It takes a little more work, but it in fact is the case. That is, this is really what's happening, and so the index itself comes out to be just in terms of that exponent, essentially, and then as you let the epsilon go, you pick up an omega from it. Okay, and the general argument, you have to do a little real analysis, basically. You just show that the upping the Schlenk index really means that you have to have a part that's moving disjointly along in terms of supports. You think of these as measures, right? You got functions going to 0 point wise, you got measures converging. They must not be absolutely continuous. So you get some moving part, moves along the derived sets of the underlying topological space, and so it's got to push out in the derived sets, and you fool around and you get this computation. And this thing, Samuel actually published this thing. A bunch of people, it was sort of in the air, a bunch of people knew this back in the 70s. Okay, now let's look at the how this is reflected in the isomorphic classification of these spaces as Banach spaces. So again, isomorphic as Banach spaces is linear homeomorphic. Okay, and so what we have, we know that the Schlenk index is an invariant here, so it's already stratified the spaces, right? It's already told us that we can distinguish things if we're changing by a multiple of omega in the exponent there. And in fact, that turns out to be exactly what's happening here. And Basaga and Pelczynski didn't use the Schlenk index to do this, but we could do it now that way. From this computation, we could actually show that these are all distinct here just by using the Schlenk index itself. And the other part of their theorem is a straight Banach space type thing. They argue that essentially you can spread out, if you take omega to the gamma times omega to the gamma times n here, you can spread it out a little bit. And let me write this down so we all can keep track of the number of omegas I'm saying. So if you take this one, by the way, I guess I skipped over mentioning this. I'm probably offending some people out here, but when I use omega to omega to gamma, C of omega to omega gamma, I'm using, right, this should be plus one, right, in the way it's usually done. So, but I'm just taking the last point as the way I'm denoting the space. Okay, so if I go here, the point is that what Basaga and Pelczynski show is that in terms of the C of K space itself, you can actually split the space apart according to this n. You can actually break it down into a C0 sum of spaces like this, but the cost of doing that depends on n. It's essentially a multiple of n to do that. And so that's how they get their result. They show you can do this, they compute the cost of it, and so they get the result there. Okay, now if you take K on an uncountable compact metric space, and one of the curious things about the theory here is that from the isomorphic viewpoint, it doesn't matter what K you take. They're all isomorphic. This follows from a famous result of Malutin that you want C of the Cantor set, you want C of 0, 1, pick your favorite uncountable space, it's all the same. Okay. All right, now let's leave this one up. Okay, now let's look at the following question. So you have an operator on a C of K. You can think of C of 0, 1 if you like. here. And you have some other Banach space X. And you compute the Schlenk index. It looks like I had a tech problem there. Of T star of the ball of X star. That's the set B, right? Relative to the ball of C of K. And you get omega to the gamma. Okay, so what are you supposed to be thinking about? You're supposed to be thinking about what C of K space that corresponds to, right? So it's one, it's C of omega to the omega to the gamma here. And the question is, can you, in fact, show that there's a subspace of, I mean, the nice thing would be that size exactly, so that the operator, when restricted, is an isomorphism. The equivalent formulation of that is to say that the set P star ball of X star norms, that is, you can compute the norm of the subspace, the vector in the subspace, which happens to be isomorphic. Now, it turned out that didn't exactly work, and but it, at first it seemed to work. Back in about 60 or so, Palchinsky did the very initial case here, where gamma and beta are both zero, and you get the same number. And then in the 70s, I got the same number for omega to the omega case here. So that's C of omega to the omega, so omega to the 1 here. But I also showed that it didn't work for 2. And Bourgain looked at this, and he worked on the combinatoric sum, and he got a result which gave an estimate. We said that things are moving up. Whoops, thank you. Things are moving up, but not quite like we'd hope. Although his result, I don't think it's tight, but it's not so obvious how you make it better. And then in the 90s sometimes, Gosseris did some of this, worked on this, and produced some more examples in his thesis, and then I refined it a little bit further. And so we know some ordinals where it doesn't work. And why do we care about such a problem? Well, one of the long-standing problems in Banach space theory is simply to classify the complemented subspaces of C of 0, 1. We don't know what they are. And I guess for a long time people felt that there were only these C of countable K plus C of 0, 1 itself, and nobody has any idea of anything to the contrary yet, but this simple idea of using the Schlenk index to give you the information isn't adequate. And we don't have really a good adequate substitution for that at this point. Okay, and this is very, a lot of what's going on here is simply combinatorial. It's, what you can, with the tools we have as far as proving the Banach space isomorphism stuff, it's purely combinatorial, what needs to happen. Now, this whole thing actually was suggested by an earlier result of Rosenthal, and it's possible, as Haskell mentioned on Monday, to deduce. Yeah, the other way, I know. I have to look up there. I can't look it down here. Haskell mentioned how this works, right? You can actually use Bourgain's results. Since you got the index moving upward, right, and if you can set things up so you can't trap the countable ordinals away from the Cantor set, then you can deduce Rosenthal's result from his, and that's exactly what Bourgain noticed. It could be done. Let me give you a couple other applications of the Schlenk index. Here's another one here. Yoav Benyamini and I did this. Whoops, we did it again. Okay, if you have a script L infinity space. Well, just think the dual is L1 of a measure. Just think of that. Okay, it just means that somehow the space is built up out of little L infinity n. But let's not worry about what that means here. But the Schlenk index is telling us something. It's telling us what kind of quotients, the size of quotients we can get. So you actually can get quotients of the right size. What it doesn't tell you is how to get the right sort of subspaces here. Another thing which was really a wonderful result was that of Maury Zipin. And that was in the separable injective problem. A big step in the solution was actually this lemma. This is a different type of application of the Schlenk index in that you are actually taking a set. You're using the derived sets, the Schlenk derived sets, to partition, basically, partition's a little strong, but to split the set up into smaller sets. And then you're identifying a subspace, essentially, of constants, the functions that are constants on the set. That's the idea here. And that's a C of alpha space. And so this is a completely different usage of the Schlenk sets than in all the other things, where it's essentially some smaller thing was being extracted every time. And so I just wanted to give you something that was had a different flavor to it here. Now I want to focus, I want to change the focus just a little bit here on what's going on and shift things away from Schlenk's original definition to something else. Okay, so I sort of mentioned this earlier in the computation of Schlenk index for the C of alpha spaces, but I want to switch very strongly to this other viewpoint now. So we want to think of the what was the weakly null sequence as we want to put X into C of the ball of X star. So we want to think now, well, the Schlenk index, that's about taking a whole bunch of weakly null sequences and doing something with it. So now let's focus on a single weakly null sequence instead. Okay? So you've got something converging pointwise, but not uniformly. Right? And now I want you to recall a standard result. It's usually in the first part of functional analysis. You learn the Hamiltonian theorem, and you learn that for convex sets, the norm and weak closure are the same. And that allows you to deduce a somewhat surprising result that if you have a pointwise converging sequence, that there's some sort of convex combinations that come out of nowhere, which converge in norm to zero. Okay, so this is a result of Mosler, and it falls out of this, but it's completely, of course, it's an existence thing entirely, because you just know something about two topologies here. So one remark here, in writing things, I'm going to follow conventions as in followed by some of the other speakers, that is, if I'm comparing subsets of integers, I mean that the top of the one is below the bottom of the other and so forth here. Okay, so we want to start thinking about this type of issue. Okay, and now let me show you an example that's from the 30s. But in a different way than it was done there. So if you remember, Thomas mentioned the Schreier sets, and maybe somebody else did too. So the very first Schreier set is just the finite subsets which start beyond their cardinality, right? So I'm using vertical bars for cardinality here. And I want to think of this not only as a family of subsets, but I want to think of it as a topological space as well. And I threw in the empty set to make sure I got something closed and in here. And so this is a set with exactly omega-derived sets here. And this sequence of functions you get by taking the sets which contain the integer, right, gives you something that converges pointwise to zero. Okay. On the other hand, because of its definition here, if you look at a set and throw away the initial half of it, you're sure to being out farther than half its cardinality. So it's one of the sets in the Schreier family itself. And so you cannot, when you compute the norm of the sum of these things, you're going to get at least half the number of them, which means that you cannot take a simple average of these functions and get it to go to zero in norm. Okay? So this very first example, it parallels the Banach-Sachs theorem, which says you can do this in some spaces. The simple averages are enough to make to go past from weakly null to norm null sequences. Okay. Now, as was mentioned in Thomas's talk, you can then do this for higher ordinals. Here. I said some of this, but see what I skipped over. I'm getting there. Okay. All right, so this was from 1930 here. And so Ted and I started looking at this, and then Spiros and I wrote these down. And so the definition was basically given previously, but just let me remind you. First, when you want to move to the next ordinal, you take K of your previous sets, but you have to start beyond K to do it. And then at a limit ordinal, you have this funny condition that you have to somehow pick a sequence out of the air somehow. And fortunately, it doesn't seem to matter very much how you do this. It doesn't seem to affect anything really important. So you do it somehow, and you define your limit ordinal case based on this choice of sequence by doing the same sort of thing going up. Now, Thomas mentioned that sometimes it's useful to have these intermediate things. He called them the fine Schreier sets. Okay, but let's look at the basic properties, or some of the properties that the Schreier sets have. Okay, so what do we got here? They have this property called spreading. Take a sequence, you push it out a little bit, and maybe stretch it out a little bit, and you still get something in there. That doesn't change. If you take a subset, you still get something in the family. So it's hereditary. As a topological space, it's, in fact, just omega to negative the alpha. It's that same space. And this sequence always gives you a sequence that converges to the analogous sequence, the Fn alphas here at the bottom, always gives you this sequence which converges to zero pointwise. Okay, so you have this for all the families. And the idea here is that, of course, as you go up in the Schreier families, things are somehow much more complex, right? They're more complicated. And you can tell that, of course, it's built into the fact that the homeomorphic type here, you can see that there must be something going on special. But to my mind, it's the interplay between this set of functions and the Schreier sets that is the most revealing part of this thing. Okay, some other remarks here. I already mentioned the fine Schreier sets. Famaki has used these, among other people. And then some people have worked on these from a combinatorial viewpoint. So one thing that was done in a work of Odell and Nicole and Wagner is to look at an operation on the families. And suppose you have something that works like the Schlenk family. That is, you got these F and G here are
finite sets.
Sets of finite sets, the hereditary spreading, and so forth. Then you can define a composition operator. In essence, I think this occurred maybe in Thomas's talk. He actually used more or less this to define his sets, because you really, somebody did anyhow, right? Because you're using the minimums from the other set, right, to form the what's admissible essentially in the new one. And so this is an alternate way to actually define the sets, is to simply use this operation here. And so what you get, or one of the things you get, is that the Schreier sets themselves are sort of closed under this, but you have to change sets slightly. So you have to take pass to an infinite subset in order to get the things to work out correctly. And so they're not quite closed, but close to it, enough that it's useful. Another thing is that you can try to look at a hereditary family and see how it compares to one of these Schreier families. Okay, so Judd and Gosperis did some work on this. The way I state it here is Yannis' theorem. So you have a hereditary family, right, and you have an infinite subset. Then there's a further subset, so that either the Schreier set of size alpha is, when you intersect it, is inside, or the reverse is true. Okay, and the Schreier sets have come to be applied in various hierarchical ways to sort of sort out behaviors. So I already mentioned that one of the initial things was Mazur's that Mazur's theorem was very non-constructive, right? But Spiros and company here worked on a type of hierarchy where you now can say what you mean by iterating the process of averaging, right? And you can do this for any ordinal because you can say what, right, you, at the first level, you just take these sets out of the Schreier system and you average over those. So I'm talking about simple average. You just divide through by the cardinality of the number of things. But then you go up, right, you take things you've constructed, averages you've constructed, and you can average them. And so by going through the hierarchy, you can say what you mean by making more and more complicated averages. And so, of course, what you're supposed to imagine is that this thing goes upward. It's very tall here, and I didn't want to waste that much ink to do that. So that's one. And then another place where these show up are in the things like the asymptotic L1 spaces. This came up recently, too, in the talk. And so in this Cyrilson space, this is the one that has the L1 version of the Cyrilson space. You want to have some idea, well, how much is this space like L1? Right? How do you pick what blocks? Well, you know that you take n blocks after n, then you get something that looks like little L1 of that size. Right? But now, lots of spaces may have this kind of property. How do you sort out the sizes of the spaces? So you run out, you need some sort of system for deciding what sort of blocks will give me L1 of behavior, and what sort of blocks are somehow too complex for this particular space to keep the L1 behavior. So this way you have a way of splitting up this L1 behavior and getting some invariance to work on the space. So that was something that was done in this paper of Odell, Tomczak, Egerman, and Wagner, is to work on that. Okay. All right, one other thing that comes out of the Schreier sets is a family of spaces that I think are kind of interesting, and these are so-called Schreier spaces. So these are essentially the span of those indicator functions that I mentioned earlier, but you can think of them as just being a sequence space with the norm computed this way here. So you just look at those particular sets from the alpha Schreier space, and you produce a sequence space norm. And Gosforth and Lung show that, in fact, just for the small ones even, you get huge numbers of complemented subspaces that are all different. So so these spaces are very rich. And somehow they're, but in terms of how complicated they are, they're a lot like the C of omega the alpha spaces. So one could start to think of things you would ask about those continuous function spaces, ask the same sorts of questions about these Schreier spaces. Now, and so here's such a question, or maybe two questions here. And that is, first, how can you detect the Schreier spaces? And you can try to detect them with the Schlenk index or some other index. How do you detect the presence of these Schreier spaces? How do you actually construct them? Turns out to be not so clear. It's pretty difficult. I looked at this a little bit. And then, is it the case that because of the sort of geometry of the Schreier space, that if it's sitting inside of a C of K, and you have something that norms it, taken out of the dual, does it in fact already norm something as large as the corresponding C of K space? Right? This is also tied up with an old question of Haskell-Rosenthal's in the theorem that I mentioned earlier, where you have the question is, his theorem requires a non-separable set in the dual in order to produce the corresponding C of K space. He had a question about, suppose you have an operator that preserves, in this isomorphic sense, a reflexive space. Is that enough to force it to preserve a copy of C of delta, say? And Borgheim proved a version of this theorem, but not quite the way Haskell asked the question. And in some sense, this is an attempt to do the same sort of thing here, where you can actually use in spaces that have much less structure. They're much smaller than C of delta and still make sense because you actually have such spaces around. So just some questions there. And now, one of the things that if you've noticed, and a lot of things we're doing here, that L1 is playing a really big role here, and it's L1 or L1 plus estimates all the way through here. And one of the things that Borgheim did at a certain point was he introduced an index which was based on trees now. So this is a different type of index than we've been talking about up to this point. So you have, in this case, the trees, we're just taking finite sequences out of some space or out of some set, and we order them in the usual way by extension. And what we want is the nice situation. So we're not going to allow any infinite branches in our trees here. We don't want that. And of course, in the case of Borgheim, his setup, let me give you the definitions now. Okay, so we'll do trees in the usual way. You define a derived set of a tree by lopping off the bottom nodes. Since you only have finite length branches, that makes sense. And so you do the usual thing here in terms of deciding the order of the tree. Now the condition is, in Borgheim's case, that each branch be an L1 of the right size. So that's what I've written down here. So you have an estimate. Now, one of the things to keep in mind about little L1 is you get something for free with little L1 stuff. The upper estimate is just a triangle inequality. So you don't have to work for it at all. And that's one of the reasons I think that all this combinatorial stuff actually works so well, is because you only have one side to worry about all the way through here. Okay. So there's our condition. We have to have L1 behavior down the branches. And if you were to allow an infinite branch, you would be allowing a copy of little L1 itself. And so this is a way of sort of quantifying partial containment of L1. So let me flash up here a few properties of the Borgheim L1 index. Okay, you've got a constant in here, but eventually you're going to let the constant go. Okay, in order to get an isomorphic, something that's isomorphically invariant. Okay, and so we want a well-founded tree, so we don't want L1. On the other hand, it doesn't say anything about reflexivity. What this index is, you can have reflexive spaces with very large index, doesn't say anything. Now these Schreier spaces, which I mentioned a little while ago, their index comes out to be, they act like, as I mentioned before, C of omega to the omega of the alpha. So the index is omega to the alpha plus one for them. Okay. Now, one of the things that was mentioned, I think, who talked about distortability? Somebody yesterday mentioned distortability. And the fact, I guess it was Ted mentioned this. One thing you can do, because it is a L1, there's a constant that's in there. To a certain extent, the constant doesn't matter. Now, there's some combinatorial things that go on there. Because of the non-distortability, for little L1 itself, you can improve the constant. Take something that's isomorphic, you can get better constant by doing a blocking argument doing the James. This is a non-distortability business. And Judd and Odell showed that you can do this even with these trees. Sometimes you lose a little. Okay, so you do lose a little, but oftentimes it doesn't hurt things too much. And so you can, if you need to have better constants, you can get better constants. Okay. Now you can modify the Bourgain index by, instead of looking at the whole ball of L1n, just look at the positive coefficient part. Okay, so replace in the definition the inequalities here by just this. Okay, so we only look at the positive coefficient case here. And you can define index in the same way. And this is what we call the L1 plus index. And this is a countable thing exactly when the space is reflexive. And this idea of using L1 plus is similar to something that Haskell's used in some of his work with C0 and this notion of wide F sequences. Okay. Okay, now, one of the things I want to talk about, too, is that sometimes you get a little interplay between these different types of indices. So, indices based on trees and indices that are these things based on taking a derivation, like a topological derivation, in the dual. So, here's a rather horrendous-looking definition the first time you see it. So let me tell you what to think about, and then if you want to struggle through the actual definition. All right. What I want to do is I want to look for points which are witnessing in a very strong way the non-uniform convergence. That's what this definition is supposed to mean. Okay? So you're looking for points where there's a lot of the non-uniform convergence about. Okay? So it's this horrible-looking mess down here at the bottom. I'm not even going to try to read to you, but it just says it jumps around a lot right near the point. Okay, so you're getting subsets of the dual, so it's like a Schlenk index, but the requirement is tougher, right? It's not quite as simple a requirement. There's a lot more activity around points that's being required here in this definition. And so this is something that Spiros and I called an oscillation index. Not to be confused with, there's another oscillation index out there. Okay. All right, so this thing is, yes, thank you. It's good to have a director here. Okay, so this is, as I just said, it's a tougher requirement than a Schlenk index. So basically this is going to be underneath the Schlenk index as you look at spaces. But the Schreier things already exhibit this. So if we take that single sequence of indicator functions, right, they exhibit the strongest possible behavior. That is, they sit on a space that looks like omega to the negative of the alpha, and they register the whole thing by this in this oscillation index. Okay. Now, an interesting thing that we discovered is that this thing is actually quite closely related to... Yes. Okay. Quite closely related to Bourgain's local L1 index. All right, so we take this sequence of continuous functions, right? It's converging. Those are supposed to be continuous functions. Right, on our space. Then you can, in fact, if the oscillation index is large, you can build a tree, which is almost the same size. You have to give up a factor here, but it's almost the same size on this. So it's very closely related. It's also closely related in another way to things that Bourgain observed about the L1 index, and that is that the L1 index is tied up with the... I'll get it just a second. That's right. Okay, so there's this index that tries to describe somehow how bad you messed up, right? You took this continuous function, you only converged pointwise. How discontinuous is the limit, right? It's Virenkiw's index. And what Bourdain shows is that this forces up the L1 index in space if your limit has high Virenkiw's index. The oscillation index registers the same thing here. Now, what I want you to perhaps keep in mind in the background here, even though we don't really have the L1, you should keep in mind the Odell-Rosenthal theorem. Because in a certain sense, this is some sort of intermediary business, right? Because there you have L1 in the space. That's the same thing as that the double dual is not the bare one functions. Right? So you have things that are limits that are... Right? They're more and more complicated if your L1 index is registering this and the oscillation index is registering this here. And of course, the extreme case is when you have L1 in the space, and then you have this very bad function from a certain point of view in there. Okay, now I've got one more index I want to talk about here, and this is again a tree index. Okay, and now we're going to take the L1 plus trees, but we're going to require a little bit more of them. Okay, so there are a bunch of technical conditions in order to make everything work just beautifully, but the main thing to keep in that we want to think about is that it's an infinitely branching tree. Every time you fork, you have to fork an infinite number of pieces. And then those are required to go weakly to zero whenever this happens. So you should have this image, right, of this tree coming down. Right, it's got a lot of starting points, and every time it splits, it's got a lot of places and so forth. But along here, right, you have weakly to zero. Whenever you look at a set of nodes at the same level that branched off, you got it going weakly to zero. Okay. All right, and again, it's because of the problem with world problem, or because of we know now that L1 is directly related to the existence of weakly null sequences. Generally, you don't want to have little L in your space, or it's going to stop you from being able to do much of anything with this index. Okay. Now, the thing that is kind of interesting about this is that you compute the index just like the Bourgain L1 index, local L1 index. But the curious thing is this theorem here. If I have a space that doesn't contain little L1, then the weakly null L1 plus index, which is compute entirely in the space, right, is giving me exactly the same index as something that's computed by a topological derivation in the dual. So here's a situation where we have this sort of duality business between a tree-like index defined in the space and its topological derivation in the dual. And so it would be curious to see whether there's some sort of general thing you can do here. Can you always do this kind of stuff? Can you, if you have derivations in the dual that are interesting, can you produce corresponding things in the space? How much of this can you work back and forth here? Okay. Do I want to go on? Okay, I've got maybe 5 minutes left. So I'm going to go ahead and say something about one other thing here. Remember, about one-third way through, I mentioned this lemma of Zipin. I've been very interested in this and trying to get more mileage out of Zipin's lemma, because this problem about the complement of subspaces of Sieve K haunted me since graduate school days. It's one of the first problems I worked on. But one of the problems with the Schlenk index as it's normally defined is that if you change the epsilon, it's very difficult to figure out what happens to the sets. You take the sets for one epsilon, you compare them with the sets for another epsilon, it's almost impossible to tell what's going on. So various attempts have been made to try to fix this problem, and one of the things is to just simply, you know, as you change the ordinal, change the epsilon. But this causes a lot of trouble. It works okay. You can make some sense of it at the finite level, but as you go transfinitely, then that starts to be a problem. So I've been working now lately with another index, and now I've messed up my transparency. In which I take a sequence decreasing to zero, and I just go ahead and use the usual Schlenk index at the first stage. But the change comes in to how to iterate this process, and that is to now define something that depends on a finite part of this sequence. So suppose you've already defined these things up to a certain place, and then you want to start, you're going to start a new derivation, as it were, here, right? So you start out, and you look at what you've done previously. So here, right, you've arrived at a new set which is sandwiched between previous sets, okay? And now you continue to move within that. So you take the sort of regular Schlenk thing, you take, but with epsilon j now is the amount of movement you're requiring, and you go down. But you don't allow yourself to pass beyond the interval where you constructed under the previous epsilon j minus 1 level. Okay, so what you're doing is sandwiching sets in between the previous ones. Okay? This way, you keep the topologies all nicely lined up here. And you're allowing epsilon to go to zero as you do it. So this gives you the possibility of doing now things like Zipin's lemma, but with iterating the construction, because your information is consistent with the previous information. And so that's the idea of this index. I'm not going to go into the details of this because the results I've been able to do so far are very technical, and so I don't want to burden you with it here. Okay.